Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. We are a community-based station broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm, Stosh Diokowski.
Is that who you are?
Yes. with a bubble there in my throat.
Our theme today is fractured fairy tales.
Whoa. So
we'll see how that develops.
They'll probably have some cracks in them.
They probably will.
That's true.
So I want to thank Andy Offit Irwin for starting us out with his original composition, Tarry Here. Just warms my heart every time I hear it. And I actually spoke with Andy 2 days ago.
Really?
That, yeah.
What was the occasion?
Try to pull off a storytelling interview with me at the Philadelphia Folklore Project about my parents' wall, the dining room wall that's in the conference room at the Philadelphia Folklore Project in West Philly. So we've been talking about that. He's going to be in Philadelphia at Megan Hicks doing a concert, and he's multitasking.
He does keep very busy.
Yeah, he does. I don't have permission. I haven't even approached the Philadelphia Folklore Project yet. So it's a maybe. It's not a done deal.
About what?
About doing the interview there in the dining room where my parents' posters and stuff are. So it's just the very beginning stages.
Right.
So I'll keep you posted about that.
Yeah. Each time I've thought, not each time, a lot of times when you've mentioned your parents and the posters and the walls and all, I think, I wish I had some of the stuff my parents have on their kitchen walls.
What did they have on their kitchen walls?
This is kind of weird for somebody who's an atheist, but we had a really beautiful version of the Last Supper that hung right against the wall where our table sat, where our kitchen table, where we ate. And for years, I wondered what happened to that. Because I know somebody in the family took it. And, not that I want it. It's just that I wonder where it went. And my mother had lots of religious artifacts. She had a Blessed Mother statue, a Virgin Mary statue that she got from us kids for their 25th wedding anniversary in 1950. And that statue now resides with my oldest niece. My niece Lydia has that. It went from, after my mother passed, it went to my sister, Marcella. And Marcella had it for many, many years. And then it went to Lydia after Marcella died. I don't value it as a religious thing. But it is an important family item.
Well, we should have a whole session, a whole program about memorabilia.
It brings up lots of different, right away I got a whole bunch of thoughts. Because there are people who have stuff in the family who I don't want them to have it.
Oh, dear.
Isn't that awful? Well, I gave some things that I thought were family, not heirlooms, but family items that were very important. you know, like my grandfather made this beautiful, my dad's father, 100 years ago, made this beautiful chessboard. It was a box with a drawer in it, but it, you know, it was about 3 inches high, maybe, and a really beautiful inlaid wood, dark brown and light, like not white but tan. So the 64, you know, squares were opposite colors. And once when I had when I had my wisdom teeth out all at once, and I was not doing anything for about 4, 5, 6 days, because I'm kind of a baby when I have surgery. I sat out in the yard in the trailer park where we were living then, and I carved a set of with a tiny coping saw and a knife, I carved a set of chess pieces, and out of white wood, and then I stained one half of them, and I gave that to a nephew of mine, whose face I want to punch every day. Because he was mean to his mother for about 10 years and then cried at her funeral. It was like, anyway, that's, you know, that's not nice. I shouldn't talk like that. No.
Well, I'm looking forward to a program about family heirlooms.
Yes. Okay. That's a good idea. I think that's a wonderful idea. You know? Okay, but
in the meantime, do you want to tell us about Speak?
Speak, yes. And I had right next to my screen here, I had one of the trifolds with all the information about Speak for this 10th anniversary season. But we had a guest earlier this week who stopped by and spent some time, someone you know, Renee.
Renee Emanuel.
Yes, and she and Terry went out for a walk together. But I gave her my copy of this. And then I realized this morning, oh, I better dash out to the garage because I had other ones in the car. And I'd given away the one I had set next to my chair here. And I remembered. So anyway, Bobby Norfolk coming up. Well, there's been a change, not in Bobby Norfolk. But he is coming in June. And there's been a change in the way we're doing things for June, at least, is he's coming for just one concert on June 14th. And so instead of being a concert on June 14th by Zoom and in person, and then a concert the next night by in person, there's only going to be a concert on June 14th by Zoom. So the truth is, Bobby Norfolk will not even be here. He will be wherever he is, and he'll be on Zoom. And because of that, I know you know that Terry, my wife, makes the posters, designs the posters for Speak. She's had to revise that same poster, I think, 3 times. And it's been approved now, it's final, and it is being printed probably this morning, and then we'll be able to put them up in different places where we do. So
well, I'm Bobby really Morkel looking forward to hearing Bobby. It's been a long time since I've heard.
And I was looking forward to seeing him, actually, because he had stayed with us in Arkansas when I hired him for the art for my story fest in Fairfield Bay. And he was a big hit. Was very interesting. I was wondering because that was, this is, well, 20 years ago or so. And I really wondered about, I know that people, I faced this in Pittsburgh with Three Rivers, the organization couldn't not have a Black storyteller. They felt it was necessary. You had to have a Black storyteller in the people you hired for Festival. And it, that had never even occurred to me in Arkansas. I never thought about, you know, how old anybody was, whether they were male or female. All I wanted to do was make sure I had great storytellers. And I did have two females and two males each year, but it never dawned on me that I should be thinking about color and about a person's race. And so Bobby Norfolk was recommended to me, and I did not know he was African American. Didn't make any difference one way or the other until I got a picture from him, you know, for publicity. And I thought, whoa, this'll probably make some waves, because there were no Black people in our community. At least I didn't know of any. And, you know, there were a couple thousand people that lived in this large area. And the school I took them to was 100% white people, white children, white teachers, white principals, all that stuff. And but shortly after I met him, I went to the airport, picked him up, brought him to the house, and he stayed with us for 3 days. After talking to him for 15 minutes, I thought, this is going to be fun, because he had me in a quiet conversation. He had me rolling inside. You know, I just asked him, do you have a lineup of stories already, or are you going to take a look at whoever's in front of you and then decide? You know, we were just conversing. He said, yeah, he said, I really am pretty well prepared, but it always looks like I'm not on purpose. He said, I try to play that in front of the audience, and not all the time, but, you know, he said, sometimes I go through a little bit of razzmatazz about, well, maybe I should tell this story. Maybe I should tell it. And he said, I do have it planned, but he said, sometimes it'll occur to me. And anyway, he told a story to a couple hundred white children sitting on the cafeteria floor. And from the moment he said good morning and began, he had them in the palm of his hand. And he had those kids laughing, and had to remind the teachers on duty there and administrator. Because at one point they tried to calm the kids down. And he said, that's really not necessary. I'm hoping to get them even more excited. He said, it's the part of the fun. Don't worry about them. They're having a good time. Something like that, you know. And he did it so calmly, professionally. And I remember thinking, when we were driving back to the house, I remember thinking, reminded me of an uncle, you know, talking to all the kids. He just reminded me of your, like, your favorite uncle, the one who could tell you about a rabbit who flew through the window or something, and you would believe him, even though you knew it was crazy. You would believe him. So anyway, I'm really looking forward to hearing him, and I will miss not seeing him.
So I have a question, Stosh.
Yes.
You've piqued my interest. So I have to ask, of course, a needling. This is probably a needling question. It's not meant
okay.
to be needling. I'm just really curious. Now, so that was 20 years ago.
Or sometime. Yeah, I'm trying to think how many. Maybe not quite 20, but sometime.
Okay. Some. In that neighborhood. So are you? Do you still feel that way, or do you still have that mindset that it doesn't matter? I mean, would you, these days, if you were putting together a festival, would you feel like there needed to be African-American tellers there, or would that still not be something you would think about?
Well, my first thing would be, if I were doing a festival and I were going to hire, say I was going to hire four tellers, my first thing would be, I want to get the four best tellers I can for at this time.
Sure.
Okay. And so I would try to get a list of 10 or 12 people and look at that and see. I would have it in my mind that I definitely want people from different backgrounds, different ethnic groups, different races. And that's because I learned a powerful lesson when I first started. When I first started doing theater, I did a lot of theater before I ever directed. And then when I started directing, I got the idea that I really liked directing. And I auditioned to direct the show, and I answered a question incorrectly. I didn't know it was incorrect at the time, but I do now, because what is the term? The term for it is not proper casting, but
traditional casting.
Yes, or non-traditional casting. Okay, and the show I wanted to direct was Our Town, and
sure.
I had seen it a number of times. I had read it a number of times, and I'd never come across a production that wasn't 100% white, Caucasian, because of the town, and historically when it was about where it was written. And I had in my mind, as a person, and you know, a beginning director, that I should stick to classics and do it the way it was done, or something like that, you know. And I couldn't have imagined at the time, because I wasn't, this isn't probably, maybe not true, and I'm being self-effacing, but I wasn't using my brain. I was trying to fit in and do it, just right. And so when they asked me about non-traditional casting and said, you know, would you have an African-American person in this cast? I said, absolutely not. African-American people in this community. So why would I do that? Well, that cost me that. Afterwards, a good friend of mine, a woman who became a good friend of mine, directed that. And she said, you know, I was in the other room and I was listening, because where they did the auditions was not, you know, like a silent thing. And she said, when I heard you answer that, I smiled and said, oh good, I'm going to get the director's job. Because, you know, she had been around a lot longer than I had. And she said, I knew right away that they were not going to pick you, because the people on that committee are bound and determined to do things more, you know, more than classical ways. So anyway, I learned that lesson then. And I didn't really put it in my mind as a learned lesson until a few years later. You know, when it dawned on me, yeah, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter if King Arthur is black or Hispanic. You know, if he can sing and he can play the part, who cares? Because I realized that it's not as important as I thought it was. So,
interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know.
We are,
18.
More than 15 minutes, 18 yeah. minutes into our program.
Yeah,
do you want to start with the Fractured Fairy Tale?
I can. How about you? Do you want to start?
I've been talking. It doesn't matter to me. I can do that.
Okay, why don't you begin?
All right. Once upon a time, there were three little worms who lived in their own separate house, each of them, but next door to their brothers. Worm number one lived in a house made of yellow straw. Worm number two lived in a house made of brown sticks. And worm number three lived in a house made of red bricks. There was an enormous and very hungry big bad bird who lived just down the road. And every day, the big bad bird would fly over to the houses of the three little worms to see if this was the day that he would be able to eat them. At the first house, the one made of yellow straw, the big bad bird pounded on the door with his big bad wings. "Let me in, little worm, let me in. I am very hungry today, and you are going to be my breakfast." But the little worm in the yellow straw house was too smart for that big bad bird. That worm just closed all the window shutters, pulled the curtains shut, and went on playing with his worm toys. The big bad bird flew over to the house made of brown sticks and pounded on the door with his big bad wings. "Let me in, little worm, let me in. I'm very hungry, and you are going to be my breakfast." But the little worm in the brown house made of sticks was too smart for that big bad bird. That worm just closed all the window shutters, pulled the curtain shut, and went on making up fairy tales to entertain his brothers when they finally got to be together later that day. So the big bad bird flew over to the house made of red bricks. But the little worm in that house was too smart for that big bad bird. That worm just closed all the window shutters and pulled the curtain shut and went on reading the encyclopedia so he could learn about the great wide world. Well, the big bad bird went hungry all that day. The next day, the big bad bird, so very, very hungry by this time, flew over to the houses of the three little worms to see if this was the day that he would be able to eat them. At the first house, the one made of yellow straw, he pounded on the door with his big bad wings. "Let me in, little worm, let me in. I'm very hungry today, and you are going to be my breakfast." The little worm in the house made of yellow straw started to close all the window shutters and pull the curtain shut and go on playing with his worm toys. But this time, the big bad bird added, "If you don't open the yellow straw door, I will flap and I'll flap and I'll flap your house right down till it's nothing but a pile of yellow straw blowing in the wind." Well, that did scare the little worm in the yellow straw house, and he slithered under the back door and humped and bumped through the tall grass of his backyard just as fast as he could, and squeezed under the door of the house made of brown sticks, just ahead of the big bad bird, who finally realized the littlest worm was about to get away and chased after him, but he did not make it in time. So the big bad bird flew to the front door of the house made of brown sticks and cried out, "Let me in, little worm, let me in. I'm very hungry today, and you are going to be my breakfast." And the little worm started to close all the window shutters and pull the curtain shut so he could go on making up fairy tales to entertain his brothers when they finally got together later that day. But this time, the big bad bird added, "If you don't open the brown door made of sticks, I will flap and I'll flap and I'll flap your house right down till it's nothing but a pile of brown sticks blowing in the wind." Well, that did scare the little worm in the house made of brown sticks and his brother, the little worm from the house made of yellow straw, who was hiding behind his big brother. And both those little worms slithered under the back door and humped and bumped through the tall grass of the backyard just as fast as they could, and then squeezed under the door of the house made of red bricks just ahead of the big bad bird. But when the big bad bird flew over to the house made of red bricks, the worm who lived there had already looked up how to manage a big bad bird in the encyclopedia and had set some water boiling in a big iron pot in the fireplace beneath the chimney. So when the big bad bird shouted out, "I will flap and I'll flap and I'll flap your house right down till it's nothing but a pile of red bricks blowing in the wind," the biggest of the little worms shouted right back, "You don't So the big bad bird went up on the roof of the house made of red bricks, and he flapped and he flapped, and that did create a terrible wind. Not enough wind to blow down a brick house, but just enough to make the fire in the fireplace flare up in the chimney so that it knocked the big bad bird off balance. And the big bad bird fell right into the pot of boiling water and was boiled into a fine, thick soup. So the three little worms had big bad bird soup for days and days after that, and it took them quite a long time to finish all that big bad bird soup. And that is what happens to big bad birds who chase after little worms who read the encyclopedia.
Whoa. Wow. Well, that was, I did not expect that.
I'm sure you did not. Okay. That was the idea.
Yeah. And all right. Well, after I tell, I'm going to tell a different kind of, well, I'm going to tell a fractured fairy tale too. And we should make an announcement that you're listening to the enlightenradio.org Tall Tales.
Or if people want to go online and hear other stories by us, they can go to talltales.enlightenradio.org.
Good. And I knew you'd rescue me as I started to say that and was fumbling with the words. I knew you would be straightened out. Because there's over 4 years worth of weekly shows on it.
That is amazing.
I know. You would think we would have gotten tired of talking.
Or somebody would have thrown us off the air. Either one.
Right, that's true. So anyway, after I tell my tale, then there is something I think we should discuss.
Uh-oh.
Well, it's a good thing.
Okay.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
So I became enamored of fractured fairy tales because of my freshman year in high school. My English teacher, last period of the day, was Mr. Nicholas Schloeder, a college football star who became a teacher and became a football coach. And he taught English, and the class I was in was not a very good academic class. Last period of the day, and he was exceptional. If we behaved all week and did our work, on Fridays, he would reach into the bottom drawer of his desk and he would sit. He would actually move his chair away from the desk. So he was just sitting in a chair, kind of isolated on the platform, because I was in a Christian Brothers school. And at that time, I don't know if they still do it, but all the teachers' desks were on a platform so that when you went up to the desk, you had to step up and you were in rarefied air there. So anyway, Mr. Schloeder would read to us. And the first day he did it, he said, I'm going to read you a story. And, you know, there were guys were rolling their eyes. But when he began, it was hysterical. Because he had this book, and I don't know where he got it. I wish I had it now. It was a compilation of fairy tales that were written in a weird manner. And I fell in love with them. Later on in life, I met John Spellman, who I studied with for 2 years. And John Spellman is one of the storytellers nationally who is known for telling fairy tales that are fractured. And I'm going to, as I begin this, you'll see what is meant by fractured fairy tales in this sense. So here we go. Rindicella and the Prancem Hints. Rindicella was a gritty little pearl. She lived with her Micked Webstuther and her two Sissy Uglers. Rindicella's two Sissy Uglers were not nice to her at all. Rindicella did all the work and they did all the complaining. She had to wean the Clindos and flub all the scores. The two Sissy Uglers were mean and had finky steed. There was a pronouncement that there would be a dancy frest ball at the castle on the sext natter day. Rindicella's two Sissy Uglers were very excited. They had dancy fresses. Poor Rindicella had none. On the day of the dancy frest ball, Rindicella did all her chores. She was sad. She watched as her Micked Webstuther and two Sissy Uglers rode in a carriage to go to the dancy frest ball. Rindicella sat in the garden and shied, hoo boo, hoo boo. Sullivan Udden, an old lady, appeared. Why are you sad? Asked the lady. Rindicella said, I don't have a dancy frest and I haven't finished my chores, so I can't go to the dancy frest ball. Well, it turned out that the lady was Rindicella's Gary Fodmother. And she waved a wand and Rindicella was in a dancy frest. The Gary Fodmother waved again and six mice turned into horses. And the pumpkin from the garden became a coach. Two right wabbits became coachmen. Now, said the Gary Fodmother, go, but be sure to leave by the Moke of Stridnight. Rindicella went to the dancy frest ball and met the Prancem Hints. They pranced all evening, and when the strop began to chime the hours, Rindicella ran to the door. As she went down the steps, she slopped her dripper. But she got into the Cadgic marriage, and off she went. The Prancem Hints was smitten by Rindicella. He took her slop dripper and shouted, I will find you. The very next day, the Prancem Hints sent out to find Rindicella. Her feet would be the only ones to fit in that slop dripper. The Prancem Hints traveled to Hairy Mouse's and finally came to Rindicella's. The slop dripper did not fit on any of the gritty pearls he had visited. Both of Rindicella's Sissy Uglers tried on the slop dripper, but both of their finky steet were too big. The Prancem Hints had Rindicella try the slop dripper, and it did fit. Rindicella and the Prancem Hints were married and lived happily after ever. The story of the Maury is, if you want to loll and fove with a Prancem Hints, just slop your dripper on the Stalus Peps.
That is a very, very funny story. I've heard Larry Hayes tell that story a couple times from memory. And it is, I don't see how anybody can keep all those crazy words straight. I don't even know if I would attempt that.
I've been doing that one a long time. And I usually, when I did it in libraries and things for children, and a couple times at schools where I did the first and second grade together, something, I would take my puppet, Juan Carlos, and he's a coyote. And I thought I would share this because at one of the places I did this in Pennsylvania, it was a group of, I guess, about 20 children. And some of them were very young and some of them were sitting with their parent. They were, I think there were one or two fathers, but mostly mothers there. And so they were all sitting on the floor in front of me. And it was when I used to play the accordion and do some songs. And also I had Juan Carlos on my knee, and Juan Carlos would tell that story.
Wow. And,
huh?
Wow.
Yeah, and I loved doing it with Juan Carlos. I was tempted to do it, but it wouldn't do any good on the radio. Nobody would see him. So anyway, when we had finished the story, and the kids liked it and the parents liked it, and there was some puzzlement I could see on the young ones' faces, but they got the story, they knew it and everything. And this one boy that was pretty close to me leaned over to his mom and said, "The puppet got the words mixed up." And that was just, that made my heart feel so good, because the whole idea of the puppet was that they would pay attention to the puppet and not me. And I had learned that from a storyteller that I saw as a very young teacher who came to a school where I was, and he told with a frog as a puppet. And afterwards I talked to him and I said, "It's amazing how the kids really watch the frog and not you." He said, "Ever since I've been doing this, I've been amazed myself every time. They really do ignore me." And he said, "Did you pay attention to me?" I said, "No, I found myself looking at the frog the whole time and wondering how he could remember all those words." And we had this great discussion. And it's true. When a puppeteer does a good job, and of course, the younger the children are, the easier it is to do a good job with a puppet, I think. Or maybe if the people were really old, it'd be easy also. That would work with me. Anyway, it's, you know, it is really neat when it works and the audience listens to the puppet and not to the old guy sitting up front.
It is a lovely story. So yeah. Do you have a repertoire of these twisted tales or?
I used to have a couple, but I stopped doing the others because I did this. Actually, I did this with a little couple notes here because I hadn't done it for a long time, but I did it for years without any, you know, notes, just me and the puppet. And I relied on that. I only did one. I remember John Spellman telling me that doing too much of that in a single performance makes the magic go away.
Yeah.
So
not to mention that it might make your mind go away.
Oh yeah. Well, I've heard
it would make my mind go away.
I heard John at Jonesboro. One of the early trips I went to Jonesboro, first time I saw him, I couldn't believe it. He told a 20-minute story.
Wow.
And there was not a single straight sentence in the story.
Whew.
And I that's one of the reasons I wanted to study with him, because that was the first time I'd heard him tell. And then I found out that he lived down near Washington, D.C. And so for 2 years, every Tuesday, with I think with a 1 month break in between, I drove about 80 miles after teaching all day. And we had a class that went from 6 in the evening until 10.
Wow.
And
dedication.
It was very intense. It was different than anything I'd ever had in my life. our first class, he put us in groups of three. There were 12 of us in a class. So we had four little groups. And we were using a like the second room of a store.
Mm-hmm.
It had store things in it, but not as much as the front room. And so we just made ourselves comfortable, some on the floor, some at a little table. And he had us tell each one of us tell a less than 5 minute story to the other two. And then afterwards, we gathered as a large group, and he said, now I want to know, do any of you think you could tell the story of the other person, you know, so that number one could tell two, and two could tell three, and three could tell one, okay. So he said, okay, go back to your groups and do that. Start with number, you know, you be number one, and you tell his story, and so on. And so we did that. And then he gathered us again. And we did that except for a break at about 8:15, we did that for almost 4 hours.
Wow.
Over.
Same story or multiple?
Same story. Over and over and over again. And 1 hour into it, I was thinking, yikes, this is worse than school. And after 2 hours, I was fixing the story in my mind. And by the end of the evening, by 9:30 or so, I thought, wow, so this is what it's like to really do a good job of learning something, where you do it over. And it reminded me so much of my military experience, where I learned to do things I had never done in my life, because if you do them about 20 times or 25 or 28 or so, they finally start to get into your brain and into your hands so that you can do the things the right way. And anyway, it was a great experience, and that's why I continued working with him for 2 years.
That sounds wonderful. Are you in touch with any of the other students?
No, we were people from all over the place. And I shouldn't say that. Actually, there was one lady in the class who we stayed in touch pretty much. And every once in a while on Facebook, I will see something from her, and we'll exchange a couple of lines. But the others we were just a real disparate group, you know. But I wanted to bring up a point about the tales. I always think of Fractured Fairy Tales as the ones with the words all mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
And what you told was a different kind of tale.
Growing up, I heard they were called Fractured Fairy Tales, and they were just different versions. They were like tongue-in-cheek versions. So.
Right. Yeah, different characters, like worms. I never heard that one before. You know, but also I have heard other tellers, you know, I heard Adam, I heard Sheila Arnold, I heard a number of others. I even heard Kevin Cordy tell a story kind of like that, where mm-hmm. where the, you know, there were not three bears, you know, yes. and stuff like that. There were three somethings or two and a half, whatever.
It is fun to put them together too.
It is. And so, you know, and with this Rindicella and the Prince of Hands, I've actually heard that with probably six different versions.
Hmm.
And I remember shortly after high school, when I was in the Army, I remember picking up a book and reading a version of the Cinderella version, and I thought, wow, that's not right, that's different than I did. Mr. Schloeder didn't do that. And then it dawned on me, of course, people have different versions of the same thing, you know. So anyway, and I'm still learning.
Well, I forgot to say, when I told the three little worms and the big bad bird, that the way I came across this story, how this story developed, I was looking for worm stories, because I'm using worms a lot when I tell for kids, and especially with Earth Day being in April, and talking about gardening and giving away plants and seeds for kids to start their own gardens, I came across this story of the three little worms and the big bad bird that according to the source I found, I've gone back and tried to find this source again, and I cannot find it. Eventually, I'm sure I'll come across it. But that story was written by a fourth or fifth grader, by a girl who's now grown up and has a blog. So she includes that on her blog. But it's also a published children's book. But I never saw the published children's book until after I had incorporated this kid's version. And I did record her name the first time I told the story, but usually I just attribute it to this child. And so I'm a little disconcerted. I have to do a whole lot more research to get back to that person and the blog so that I can credit her. And I feel really badly that I haven't spent more time on that so far. You are muted, so I'm having difficulty hearing you.
Yes, I guess you would. And I did that so I wouldn't disturb, you know, so
my train of thought.
Speaking, yeah. And but you are acknowledging that, even though you don't say her name, mm-hmm. you're acknowledging that, you know, that it's not you and it's somebody in a special way.
Well, to me, it's brilliant. And I haven't read the children's book. Right. So I've seen the illustrations, and I think it's really a slightly different story, but
yeah.
just from perusing it at a glance, but I should do more research on it.
Yeah. I think it's wonderful when people can create an original story, and I'm not sure. Oh, this is probably true of lots of people, especially once you don't do as much as, or once you stop doing as much as you did and slow down stuff. I found lately that when I have an idea for a story, I don't have as many ideas as I used to have. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah. And so because I began working on a story for two of my grandchildren, about a dragon in their lake. And I have some ideas about doing it, but I was amazed when I first started scratching down on a pad some ideas, how few ideas came to me.
I'm guessing once you get thoroughly engaged, you'll have more.
I think I will, but I was surprised that I didn't have as many as I would have had before.
Yeah.
And I just think part of that might be also I'm easily distracted. You know, I know you've seen Andy Offit Irwin do this squirrel. And I that happens to me a lot during the day, that I get distracted.
Oh yeah. I get that.
So do you have another story?
Not immediately. I might be able to come up with one, but I'm guessing you have another story.
Well, what's the, actually, I don't. I didn't, I'm not prepared. I mean, I did, yeah, okay. I didn't prepare two because I was thinking that you probably would have six or seven. Anyway. But I think we could continue the conversation along this line is as a challenge. What would be a story that you've not done and I have not done that we could rewrite as a fractured tale in either the way, you know, your story was with changing the characters and...
Well, I do have a version of Little Red Riding Hood that I think you've heard. It would take me a few minutes to remember it because I haven't told it in a couple of years. And then I also had a version of Little Red Riding Hood in Spanish where
in Spanish.
I told the story in Spanish. I think I've done that on the air.
In Spanish?
In Spanish, yes.
I didn't know you could speak Spanish.
Well, I can muddle in Spanish. I speak better than I understand. My comprehension is not all that great, but with enough time to prepare,
right,
I can come up with short stories in Spanish. But talk more about your idea. What kind of thing do you have in mind?
Well, like, if we could choose a fairy tale and not discuss it, and then come back in a week or two and perform the same fairy tale, you know, you do your version, I will do mine, and I think we could have fun with it. But with no hint of what we would be doing until we actually began on the radio telling.
Well, that's an interesting idea. I know other tellers have done that together. I know Adam and Sheila do that every year, don't they?
I think so.
They do a competition.
That's what I was thinking of when I thought this would be fun to do. But I don't know. What fairy tale would you suggest? We only have a few minutes left on the show anyway, so.
We have
51.
Minutes. Yeah.
Yeah, we're at 51 minutes. So what fairy tale would you
say? I would have to think further.
Oh, okay.
I have a really short version of Red Riding Hood that I can tell.
Go ahead.
Once upon a time, there was a little girl who lived in a tiny house in the forest with her Aunt Lupita and Uncle Tomas. The little girl was always called Red because she had a red cape with a hood that she wore all the time, made just for her by her grandma, who lived on the other side of the forest. One day, Auntie Lupita said, "Red, Grandma is not feeling well. Take her this basket with soup, pastry, and oranges, but take care. There is a wolf in the forest." Red said, "Yes, Mama," and ran off into the forest with the basket. In the forest, by the side of the road, sat the wolf. He was wearing a jaunty hat and a blue t-shirt that said, "Save Indigenous Species." But he was thinking to himself, I am hungry. I am so hungry. And when the wolf saw Red, he said, "Hello, little girl, where are you going?" Red said, "Oh, hello, I'm going to Grandma's house with this basket of soup, pastry, and oranges." "Ah, and where does your grandma live?" Now, in this version of the story, Red continues on the road to Grandma's house while the wolf takes a shortcut through the forest, knocks on Grandma's door, pretending to be Red. Grandma lets him in, but when she sees him, she is so frightened, she runs off into the forest, headed to Red's house for help. Red arrives at the house and knocks, finds the wolf in bed, pretending to be Grandma, and there is a series of questions, ending with, "Grandma, what big teeth you have! The better to eat you with." Whereupon Uncle Tomas arrives with a gun and Red's Jack Russell Terrier, who corners the wolf. Red notices the wolf's t-shirt under Grandma's nightgown on the wolf, reads the slogan, "Save Indigenous Species," and convinces Uncle Tomas to have a conversation with the wolf. Together, Red, Uncle Tomas, and the dog learn that the wolf has recently joined an interspecies reparations and reconciliation group, but he is struggling with some of the concepts. The next meeting is that very afternoon. The wolf agrees that if they will attend with him to explore who owes what to whom and how much, he will do his best to stop eating people.
That's very good. That's wonderful.
And you know, all these versions of Red Riding Hood and the wolf came out of that workshop we did with Kevin Cordy.
Oh my goodness.
He had us choose a story and a fairy tale and fracture it or change it.
Yeah, I remember that. I've done that workshop with him a couple times. And the one at your house was less of fun.
It was very good for me. Laura First and I were partners in that workshop. And
right.
We worked on Red Riding Hood together.
I remember. That's where I met Laura.
Oh.
That was the first time. Yeah. And boy, I would love an excuse to be able to get Kevin to come and stay at my house again for a few days.
Right.
But there hasn't been any kind of opportunity. And, you know, because he is super house guest, you know. And he and I talked late into the night and early in the morning and, you know, shared a whole lot of things. He was another person that I hired in Arkansas for the Story Fest there. And he really wowed the people. The people in Arkansas were absolutely flabbergasted by his story about the polar bear in the ocean, which he did at your place.
Yep.
So
what would your recommendation for us for a tale for us to tandem?
I don't know. I think we should think about it and submit a couple to each other.
Okay.
And then agree. We can do that by you know, text or email or something. Mm-hmm. And then you know.
That sounds good.
Yeah. I have a question for you because you're an expert in this.
Uh-oh.
Do you happen to have, if you had this thing, I would be thrilled. Do you happen to have a megaphone? not an electric one, but old cheerleader kind.
Because, and you say I'm an expert because I'm a big mouth.
No, because you have things for sale in different people's, you know what I mean?
I think so. No, I do not have a megaphone. I have made them, but just, you know, simple things out of cardboard, nothing. Yeah. And I haven't saved any of them. They were not.
I'm studying one, making them. I made one yesterday. Because I'm going to be doing something at the local library,
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to do like an in-person performance. I am going to just show up once in a while for the story time and STEAM, STEAM, the young woman at the Martinsburg Library here, who's in charge of the children's area. She and I got together and we talked and everything. So I did show up once and show the kids Twirly Dingers, the helicopter thing. And so we decided that on certain Tuesdays when she's telling stories, actually she reads stories to the kids, that I would show up. If I knew the topic, I might show up with something. And so I'm going to do, she's going to do some stories about sound on June 7th. And I'm going to show up with an ear harp and a megaphone. Because I want to teach the kids about reversing the megaphone.
Okay. Well, and we will look forward to hearing what happens.
And so I went on YouTube and I did make a megaphone. I had a piece of paper, but now I have to investigate what size piece of paper I need to get from Hobby Lobby or someplace like that, so that I can make a megaphone that's about 2 feet tall.
Okay. I probably need to close the show because I think we're over time. This is Fanny Crawford.
And Stash Ziolkowski.
Your co-hosts for the Noontime Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. We are independent community radio from Bolivar, West Virginia, and we're done for the day. The Enlightened Storytelling Hour offers our listeners a window into the world of telling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. But stay tuned, because next up...
Australian blues, celebrating the election of the Labour Party.
All right.
Whoa. Wasn't that an upset?
Yeah, I think so. I wouldn't expect a gigantic change, but
yeah.
I got a suggestion, a thought. No.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Very well. I just, you know, in my experience, like people, when they think about stories, they think about biblical stories, you know, more than they do fairy tales, just in my experience, you know, and they tell them or retell them or refer to them, you know. So I was suggesting maybe you could try Adam and Eve.
Adam and Eve.
You know, and there's a lot of ways to tell that one. And the other one, of course, that if you want to get serious, is Abraham and Isaac.
Hmm. Okay, something to think about.
Oh boy, wow. And we have experience with Adam and Eve.
Yep. From the theater, from the play.
Right. And Abraham and Isaac, what is his name now? Forget it. A wonderful storyteller who has passed away. I saw his last performance. Who?
Lieberman, Sid?
Sid Lieberman, yes. He did one hour and five minutes or so. Story of Abraham and Isaac, and I knew nothing about it, no background, there was no explanation about it, and I know probably some of the audience knew ahead of time. I thought it was going to be a biblical story, but I really liked him, so I didn't care what he was telling, you know. It was about Lincoln and a soldier named Isaac. And it was a brilliant story about Lincoln visiting a soldier who was wounded. And Lincoln was in the area near this, I guess like a field hospital, and he visited the young soldier a number of times.
He actually did that at Antietam, or in Sharpsburg.
Really?
Sharpsburg, yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that. Of course, I didn't know anything about Sharpsburg. I didn't even know Sharpsburg existed until Terry found it. Mm-hmm. When we moved from Pittsburgh. And I did know about Antietam by the name, mm-hmm. but you've heard this song and dance from me before, but I could care less about battlefields and things like that. So I have no interest. I've only been to Antietam one time, and that was because when we first moved to Sharpsburg years ago, 2017, we took my daughter and her husband and grandson.
So now that you know the kinds of stories that can come out of those battlefields, does that make any difference?
No.
Okay.
The stories may be interesting to me, and I have certainly read a lot about certain areas like that, but I don't see any sense in honoring places where people killed each other. Doesn't make sense to me to, you know, go and stand there and say, yeah, 10,000 people died here, and because all I think of is it never changed anything. You know, tell Mr. Floyd, you know, how his life was improved by the Civil War. You wouldn't get an answer because he was killed, because he was black. and you know, those kind of things. And I am so, so, so anti-war. You know, it just is the stupidest activity of human beings. You know, no war has ever fixed the problems.
The story that I know about Lincoln visiting at Sharpsburg at Antietam came from Tolson's chapel story about a woman who was enslaved on the farm that served as the field served as the hospital after the battle. And she was likely there when Lincoln visited. And I told a bit of that story at Tulsa. So that's how I came to that. Okay.